or right as the speakers were arriving, the principal refused to allow them into the classroom to speak. So I and several colleagues started a petition saying that teachers' academic freedom needs to be protected. And also, we wrote the people in central admin and human resources, and they did not have a justification for what they're doing. And I was just pointing out the hypocrisy of that when, you know, they let everyone from military recruiters to people from corporations and junior achievement come speak in classrooms all the time and never question that. Yet people from the Occupy Portland education panel was considered too controversial and would need prior parental approval before they would be allowed to speak.
Basically, you sort of won both of those battles. They were unable to shut you up, but it was frightening for a while, I understand.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was willing to put myself at risk because they just were not being accountable. And if it means that I get into trouble to have an opportunity to get them to speak publicly about these issues that they haven't been willing to respond to me about, would be great.
Young, let's get into your challenge to testing. In fact, it's continued. When you began, there was a lot of teacher questioning and opposition to testing. Well, the testing has gotten worse, and teacher opposition, you were sort of a lonely voice at the beginning, or at least you were one of the first to speak up. Now it seems to me that the opposition to testing, especially as it becomes more and the stakes of it get greater and greater, now that opposition has intensified and borne some fruit in the recent contract, not as much as any people would want, but some. And it raised the question and became a contractual question, so that was good. Tell us why you're now taking off after the testing regime.
Well, teachers have, both here locally and all over the country, have just been fed up with these tests and losing teaching time to these tests and the effect that these tests have on our students. So more people are speaking out. Instead of being demoralized, they are finding the courage to stand up and in some cases, like in Chicago recently, even face allegations of insubordination to refuse to administer these tests that are a waste of time and that are actually harmful to the students. And I think more and more people are being inspired by these courageous acts, and we're going to see these kinds of things happening with teachers, students, and parents opting out of these tests all over the country.
Let's get into the terrible impact of high-stakes testing on the schools. It's partly just a matter of huge amounts of time are being devoted. Partly it's a matter of the money that the test companies are demanding for their whole, and it's not just for the test, but it's the whole curriculum. I think primarily for teachers is that it's an effort really to reshape curriculum, how you teach.
Well, I think it's even bigger than that. I think what I'd like to do is start with the big picture, because in a way, testing just serves one function in what's happening with education that is basically being dominated by a business model of reform. And basically, it's run by business interests and business groups that are turning education into a business. It's very strategic for them because really, this is coming at this time when we have this major crisis in our economy and really crisis in capitalism. And that crisis is being transferred to public schools, to teachers, to unions, to students that actually masks the actual crisis and the causes of the problem. And we see that everywhere from the World Bank talking to countries like Mexico saying that they need to privatize their education or have more accountability measures and testing, to Obama, to the Oregon Education Investment Board, to our local school boards as well. I mean, if you think about it, you know, whether we're thinking about Obama or Governor Kitzhaber, think about the fact that Obama hires Jeffrey Immelt from GE, the CEO from GE, to be the heads of the Jobs and Competitiveness Council, right? The guy from a corporation that paid no taxes. Actually, I believe they got millions of dollars back from the government while paying zero taxes and outsourced thousands of jobs, making millions of money for executives. And he is supposed to be the leader of jobs and making America competitive. And the whole premise of this attack on public education is always talking about college and career readiness for the 21st century global economy.
And they also blame poverty in America on teachers and teachers' unions.
Absolutely.
And that discourse says there really wouldn't be poverty if the schools were better so that children could move easily into all of these high-paying jobs. It's really bizarre, but they get away with it.
It's a huge diversion. I mean, you would think, if you listen to Obama or Kitzhaber, you would think that all our economic problems are because of public education, whereas what really caused the fiscal crisis? It's not teachers' pensions, right? It was the financial meltdown. Or why are states struggling with their budgets? It's because of the recession. It's because of tax cuts that we've been giving to corporations and the wealthy for years and years and years.
And it's because of outsourcing of decent jobs and destroying unions and putting pressure on workers' wages. More and more people are poor. Fewer and fewer jobs pay a living wage.
Exactly. And it's just crazy to think that some of the main groups that are pushing these education reforms are the Waltons, right? The people that own most
of the hedge funders.
And hedge funders. And it would make you think that, oh, these are the people that are most concerned about children in America. I mean, how is it that people think that people like, you know, the people that run Walmart care about students while they're in school for 6.5 hours, while they really don't care about them and their families the rest of the time with the kind of wages that they pay as one of the largest employers in the country?
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here, talking to Hyung Nam, teaches at Wilson High School. He's also has played a major part early on in mobilizing teachers against these sort of changes in schools, particularly with high-stakes testing as the central mechanism through which basically corporate forces are trying to ultimately eliminate the schools as well as take over the curriculum. Hyung, how is it that the high-stakes testing now leads to teaching to the test and a tremendous corruption of the teaching process?
Well, in Portland public schools, that hasn't quite happened yet, but it is looming, and especially next year as the new Common Core state standards come out and the tests associated with that are implemented. Yeah, I mean, just backing up a little bit, you know, I think if we look at, again, this big picture of what's happening in the economy and how education speak is being rammed down people's throats, we have a crisis with our economy and unemployment. Education reformers and people like Obama make you think that, well, you know, we have this unemployment crisis because people's test scores or, you know, failure in education, which is completely masking the real problems that are going on. And really, I think the purpose of testing is to sort and rank students and exclude people into a social order that we have in this economy that is increasingly competitive, but really does not offer good and realistic opportunities for the majority of people. Right now, we have a record number of college graduates that are in debt, that are practically indentured servants. So I think we really need to see the use of testing in that context. I mean, it's completely ironic, too, because if you think about it, you know, these standardized tests cannot help the so-called free enterprise system that is supposed to depend on innovation. These tests are impossible to assess a student's ability to think creatively, to think critically, to think outside the box, to collaborate, to construct knowledge, to deliberate, to problem solve, to innovate, to take multiple points of view, to empathize, to get inspired, to experience joy, to make meaning in relation to one's own life and world. These are all the things that are really going to make a difference in our world and even in the economy as well. But it's impossible to assess for those kind of skills or even develop those kind of skills if we're training kids to bubble in one of the answers out of four choices in a test that some particular corporation constructs.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to Hyung Nam, who teaches at Wilson High School, is a critic of the testing regime and all of it that it brings with it. He pointed out in a wonderful list of sort of qualities that you would want to, in fact, help kids develop in a school that teachers around the country are increasingly coming to, and especially in the public schools and in the schools of education, enormously successful and engaging and stimulating curriculums and pedagogies and ways of helping kids develop really are becoming more used and available to teachers. And I know you spend a good deal of time developing pedagogy and curriculum, whatever, how you're going to teach and how you're going to bring students into real active learning. Why don't you tell us about some of the, I call it somehow the Rethinking Schools model or the student-centered model. Tell us about how you teach and how so many other, especially social studies teachers in this city teach.
You know, I should say, and I want to say this earlier as well, that, you know, it's not like I'm some kind of like special person or hero doing anything like this. I'm just kind of struggling to figure this out because I want to teach, and I see education as being really important. And in that, I've learned a lot and work with many other educators in the city and throughout the country. And you mentioned Rethinking Schools is one of them. Rethinking Schools, also other groups, like we have the Portland Social Equality Educators and many colleagues that are part of what I'm doing here as well. But as far as curriculum goes, I've learned a lot through the publications that we have in Rethinking Schools, probably one of the most famous being Rethinking Columbus that Howard Zinn talks about in People's History of the United States. It's a pedagogy that involves doing things like role plays where students learn issues from multiple perspectives. They learn how to problem solve where it's not like there's some consumer choosing one option in a limited framed standardized test, but they're coming up with their own solutions. And so they're having to be creative. They're having to collaborate together and work together. And it's a very different model of learning than what we have in corporate textbooks and standardized testing. And also, not only the pedagogy, but the content as well, I think, is an important issue. I mean, there's so many very interesting things for students to learn about, in especially social studies, that if you look at the typical social studies textbook, you just will not see it all. Because, you know, the goal of these testing companies and the textbook publishers that are increasingly tied together is to get mass adoption. And now with the new Common Core state standards that have been approved by many states willingly or unwillingly, there is this gigantic market that these publishers have never had before. And their goal is to sell this material to every state and every, you know, school district. And in doing so, they really limit the content, because if there's anything in there that whatever fringe group or whatever would consider too controversial,
or the Texas Book Commission,
or the Texas Book Commission,
radical conservative,
then they will leave those things out. So if you look at what is actually taught in at least social studies textbooks, it's horrible. It's not only boring, but it just really, it lies through omission. If you look at the way that it talks about the economy, in the economy, it's not even lying by omission, it's actually lying. But when it's talking about history, many lies by omission, and it, I think it really turns students off to these subjects and the importance of understanding the economy or history, etc.
Or, in fact, their own lives or the challenges that they face and their neighborhoods face and their friends face. I mean, one of the interesting things I think that's happening in schools is sometimes whole schools will, teachers will collaborate on a curriculum where they take a project and sort of examine something. Let's say their local watershed. Well, to understand your local watershed, you have to understand math, you have to understand history, you have to understand land patterns, you have to understand the chemistry of all of the stuff that we're pouring into the water.
Exactly.
It seems to me that that kind of exploration, there's a lot of teachers now who do it and who aren't particularly radicals. They just know that kids learn so much better when they have real problems. They can go out and interview people.
Yeah.
They can make little radio programs about it. And if anybody wants to come here with the KVU, with your radio documentary of your neighborhood studies by students, that would be great. It seems to me those projects will involve kids as well, because they're even talking to their neighbors, they're talking to their parents.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think those kinds of things are so important, but it becomes increasingly difficult for teachers to do that, because part of it is the workload. The workload has just been increasing as we cut funding for schools. I mean, think about Oregon being one of the states with the lowest, some of the lowest business taxes in the whole country, where we hold special sessions of our legislature so that we can guarantee tax cuts in the future for major corporations, global corporations. At the same time, we're something like number four worst in the country for class sizes. I believe we're something like number three worst for how much tuition students have to pay to get a college education at a public university. It's horrendous.
Of course, we're worst, but the others, even if they're better, class sizes in comparison to what the elites
Absolutely.
Have their kids study with, where there's 15 or 16 in a class, there's no state in this country that comes close to that. And in fact, rich people are always saying class size doesn't matter.
Exactly.
But for their children, of course, it does. And it, of course, it does matter because especially children, maybe at the university level, you can listen to lectures and incorporate material and have your own discussions with friends. But children need a lot of attention, and they need stimulation. They need a helping, supportive person.
Yeah. And actually, it's not just class size. It's the total workload for teachers, and especially if we're talking about high school teachers, because if you have teachers teach with a smaller class size, but you make them teach six classes, and they have to have three different preps or four different preps for different classes and have that many classes, that adds up. And when we're talking about doing the kind of curriculum that engages students in relevant learning with what's happening in their world and their lives, that takes a lot of time to prepare something like that. And increasingly, as teachers don't have time for that, it's more and more convenient for corporate publishers to have their canned and scripted curriculum that basically de-skills teachers and is kind of teacher-proof curriculum that you can have ExxonMobil influence what goes in the textbook talking about the BP disaster and have a scripted lesson that teachers don't have to write and they can just use it, and then they don't have to do any real assessing of student work, just give a multiple choice bubble test that you stick in the Scantron, and that works with the kind of workload that they are imposing on teachers these days.
Young ma'am, we ended on the low note of how the whole high-stakes testing system. I think we want folks, though, to remember the high notes of the alternative to that, which is, how should we call it, Nam? What is it, the rethinking schools model, the student-centered model, the active learning model? Is there a code word for it?
I don't think there's any one code word, but we can look at alternative models going all the way back to someone like John Dewey. And it's also about recognizing that teachers were education workers, but were also professionals who are trained and educated to educate our students. And we need to rely on our teachers and support teachers in being these public intellectuals and in educating our students, rather than trying to impose these accountability measures and trusting groups like the Waltons to be in control of what happens in our classrooms.
Young Nam, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Bill.
Hi, folks. That was me, Bill Resnick, talking to Young Nam, Portland teacher, who's on schooling, testing, and the alternatives to corporate control education and their scripted curriculums and constant testing. I pre-recorded that interview yesterday. This coming Thursday at 6 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, we have a KBOO is sponsoring a event. The Schools Portland Children Deserve, after the contract, the Schools Portland Children Deserve. It's sponsored by the Portland Association of Teachers, Oregon Save Our Schools, a mostly parent group, also the Parent Student Union, and of course KBOO. The panelists will present much more on these same issues that I talked to with Young Nam, discussing the recent struggle, discussing and showing many more examples of wonderful schools and programs, showing how teachers are building engaging and stimulating schools and programs in which students learn material and they also develop a love of learning and thinking. We can build schools that are for young people much more appealing than the popular culture served up by corporate America. Kids really do like to go to schools. The panelists will include Gwen Sullivan, the president of the Portland Association of Teachers, who led teachers and organized parents in the recent contract fight. Also speaking, Steve Buell, a school board member and a representative of the Portland Student Union. That's this Thursday at 6 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, Southeast 26th and Clinton. And after the panel, around 7:30, we will show the film, An Inconvenient Truth, about Waiting for Superman. That's Thursday at 6 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, Southeast 26th and Clinton.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. The productivity of the U.S. labor force has and continues to grow by leaps and bounds, at the same time as the real wages of workers stagnate or are even in decline. How is this possible? The following is an article by Geoffrey McDonald entitled "The Revolving Door of Unemployment: Is Growth the Cure for the Consequences of Growth?" in which McDonald discusses and explains this seeming paradox. Obama does not hide the facts about unemployment, McDonald begins. He insists on it. He relates the hard luck stories of ordinary citizens who, through no fault of their own, have been laid off and unsuccessfully looking for work since the start of the Great Recession. The miseries that America's economic system imposes on its citizens do not fill him with shame because unemployment constitutes a universally lamented social problem. Everybody feels for those who need work, but can't find any. But where does this strange need come from? Why is it that people are not able to perform the work they need to meet their basic requirements of living? The reason is quite simple. People are separated, by law, from the means of work. They would work, but they do not have the means to work. It's not up to them whether they work or not. In this society, they can't take the simple step from being able to work, wanting to work, and needing to work, to actually working. That's because there is a condition that must be met before they can work. Only if they find somebody who possesses the means of work and allows them to use these means can they work for their own livelihood. Moreover, workers are not allowed to use these means of work only for their own needs. They have to work longer and produce more than just for themselves. They have to produce a surplus for the owner of the means of work that is higher than their own remuneration. They can work only for themselves if they increase the property of somebody else first. In this economic system, surplus labor is not the labor that is performed after all the necessary labor has been done and all the basic needs have been met. Surplus labor is the condition for the labor that the whole society needs. It's completely absurd. Millions of people suffer deprivation, have no income, and fall ever deeper into poverty because a barrier is set between them and their ability to work. Profit. Unemployment is an indicator of the enormous increase in the productivity of labor. More and more products are generated with fewer and fewer people. Millions are not needed because workers... Millions are not needed because workers who are still needed are so productive that everything the employers want to have produced at a profit has already been produced. In other words, people are unemployed, made redundant because of abundance. Productivity advances throw millions of people into destitution. Productivity increases do not take place to make work easier or to give people a good life. The employers continuously increase the productivity of labor with automation and artificial intelligence to cheapen their labor costs. They have more products produced in the same time or the same amount of products produced in less time. They do it to lower their total advance in wages. The result is that work becomes cheaper for them and they make more profit. They make paid work efficient for their profit by making it ever cheaper for themselves. By using workers more efficiently and more intensely, they cut down on their costs, and that is what workers are for them, costs to be reduced, to be minimized. The livelihood of workers, that is wages, are always a contradiction to the goal of companies, that is profit. While material shortages do not exist in this society, it is also not the case that everything that would be somehow useful or nice exists. What teacher doesn't want smaller classes? What nurse or patient doesn't want more nurses in hospital rooms? This work, no matter how badly it is needed, is not socially necessary in capitalism. The standard for social necessary labor is defined by those who are called the economy, And an economic term simply means work that creates a product with a price that sells at a profit. In capitalism, socially necessary labor is labor that makes profit. Other types of work that would be socially beneficial do not take place because it does not create anything interesting financially. It doesn't lead to profit. The government recognizes unemployment as an unwanted but inevitable side effect of the economic success on which it is so keen. So when it fights against this problem, one that is included in its form of success, it always has the same measure as a remedy, more of the growth that creates unemployment. When those in power express concern about unemployment, why does this backfire in their faces? Why doesn't anybody yell, what kind of idiotic problem is it when wealth and prosperity throw people into distress and poverty? This is because the subject undergoes a transformation that is barely recognized. What begins as a concern for the plight of the unemployed ends as a concern for profit and the health of the economy. What begins as a show of sympathy for the hardships of the unemployed turns into criticism of the burden that the unemployed put on the state and its budget. What begins as a self-criticism of the government that has not done enough to provide workers with opportunities ends as a criticism of the unemployed. Key words, skill shortages, or education gap. The business leaders gathered at the White House have no problem with unemployment. Not only do they create it, but it serves them quite well because a high number of job applicants presses down the wages of those still employed. But they are not elite businessmen for nothing. They know a bargain when they see it. In return for a small pledge that they will not discriminate against people, they have thrown in the street. They obtain public acknowledgement for their whole agenda, in Obama's words. There are steps we can take to streamline our tax code, to incentivize companies to invest here. So we've got to grow faster and put more shoulders behind the wheel of expanding growth, end quote. This is music to their ears. What about the long-term unemployed? What does Obama offer them? Quote, giving up on any American is something America cannot do, end quote. He does not give up on these citizens who have been rendered superfluous, but counts them up each month and recognizes them as still having the potential to serve growth. He promises them nothing, but makes a demand. They must make themselves more suitable, flexible, and cheaper for the future jobs that might still require them. In return, they get a fair shot, exactly the same thing they've always had. It's their God-given right as hardworking Americans to compete on the labor market with the only thing they've got, their ability to make the rich richer, and the freedom to starve if they don't. That was an article entitled The Revolving Door of Unemployment, Is Growth the Cure for the Consequences of Growth? By Geoffrey McDonald. McDonald is an editor of Ruthless Criticism. Now Bill Resnick is back with us to discuss the current crisis in the Ukraine.
Hi, folks. I'll be discussing, doing a commentary on the Ukraine. So what's up there? Like a good newsy that I am, I read a lot of stuff. Last week, I was reading about the latest crisis in the Ukraine, and lo and behold, it was like reading about the Syrian crisis. That is, all the same issues arose. Like, for example, are these real revolutions from below against tyrannical regimes? If so, have they been hijacked by jihadist or Nazi elements? And what was the role of outside powers, powers like the U.S. and Russia with no interest in democracy and lots of interest in projecting that power? And did the creation of autonomous zones held by different groups in those countries reflect legitimate aspirations for self-determination, or were they just big power plays supported by those powerful outside interests? All these questions are vigorously argued in the press, including the progressive newspapers, journals, blogs, even argued on TV. That is, if you watch Democracy Now! On TV, the rest of the TV just parrots the U.S. line. Anyway, reading a lot, I realize that progressives have different takes on these issues. And I also realize that I really have no capacity to distinguish whose analysis is most accurate on the Ukraine. But that's okay, because just raising the question does sharpen one's analytic capacities. It does direct folks to the right questions. And if you read enough, you come to know which analysts are worthy of some trust. More important, though, it is often impossible to know for sure about a lot of things. If it's impossible to know for sure about a lot of things, still with lots of reading and movement work, We can know enough so we can be absolutely sure about the major things, that enable us to lead a fully engaged and meaningful political life. Like, I know that democracy works. I see it in action, including to a large extent at this radio station. I also know that while democracy is possible and practiced in some radio stations and millions of cooperative enterprises, I know that democracy works in many political groups and in some schools and in many, many families too, though as to families, of course, the extent of children's participation does depend on their maturity and capacity. I know that democracy has worked even in some cities and from time to time in some whole countries, like the anarchist side in the Spanish Civil War, and maybe also in parts of Venezuela and Zapatista Mexico right now. So while I know that democracy is possible, I know that no big power country in the world approaches democracy. No country on this planet is democratic, and that includes this one. That in all of the big power states, elites accept democratic institutions only to the extent that their wealth and power is not threatened. And when elites are threatened, they use whatever force is necessary to marginalize the opposition, including mass murder if they can get away with it. I also know something very important, that the only way to defeat these elites is with mass movements and general strikes, such that the military refuses to shoot, and some of the military then comes over to our side. And the elites come to recognize that they can't kill all the people all by themselves, that they have a lot to lose and could well lose everything, and indeed, and their lives too, and that they are better off leaving power and striking the best deal they can get. That has happened a lot in history. I also know something else, that every country on earth has huge inequalities. I know that 30 million children a year die from hunger and malnutrition. I know that the rich keep driving for more, those unhinged, pitiful people who believe they are better and hire so many security guards to protect their treasures. And I know that the drive by the rich for more, ever more, will sooner or later destroy the planet. As David Suzuki points out, exponential growth is the creed of the cancer cell. So I'm going to conclude. I really don't know everything about Syria, the Ukraine, Crimea. I could spend my life studying those things and maybe still argue about all of the issues. And there's so many other smoldering little horrible wars. But I do know for sure what's really important, that I'm going to join with others in the effort to build democracy and democratic movements, and that someday we will create a democratic world with sustainable economies. Of course, we really have to act soon. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Concluding our program today is another installment in our Left and the Law series with commentators Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker, who will discuss Texas's new progressive law, yes, you heard right, a progressive Texas law that will actually allow innocent people to get their convictions overturned. They talk about what's important about this law for the massive numbers of people incarcerated nationally as well as in Texas.
Well, Mike, you were cited quite extensively in a recent Atlantic piece on this case of Rigoberto Avila, who was sentenced to death in Texas for child abuse, and the ruling that permitted an appeal based on scientific evidence submitted by experts during the trial. You also refer to this issue as junk science. Can you tell us a little about the case, and then we'll talk about this whole concept of junk science?
Robert Avila was convicted of murdering a 2-year-old child. And the primary evidence against him, which was the testimony of an expert who said that this child's wounds could not possibly have resulted from a normal child fall, that the kid would have to fall from at least 20 feet or be purposefully thrown down. That was the key evidence resolving a case that was otherwise ambiguous and strange and hard to figure out. But that was what jurors in that case grasped. That's what resolved all these difficulties.
And so how were those injuries later explained? Because it seemed not such a stretch. You mean, if you looked at the evidence at the time, that this child had massive injuries and was in the care of Mr. Avila.
They were resolved. The new case, the reopening of his case, is as a result of experiments done by doctors showing that the injuries could easily have been resulted from the fall of 4 or 5 feet. And there was a shelf there. There was also a 4-year-old kid who was messing with the 2-year-old kid, quote unquote. And there are other possible explanations other than a deliberate infliction of a motiveless crime that no one by Mr. Avila.
Wasn't there also an issue around the confession and the process of his signing an agreement in the original testimony that was submitted that it included a confession?
There was a confession, but there was also lots of evidence showing that it was coerced.
So that's another issue but that wasn't the issue, these false confessions and interrogation practices. That wasn't at stake in this particular statute and law that was passed around junk science.
No, because that confession was like a lot of confessions, sort of compelling on its own, but then there was a lot of evidence that he was coerced, that he was led to do it, and that created exactly the kind of uncertainty that got resolved by the expert testimony.
So experts play an important role in deciding and kind of tipping the scales one way or the other. And in the Atlantic piece, you say that our priests are now scientists and doctors. What do you mean by that? And can you say how you, there's an implication that there's a religious aura around scientists and doctors in the courtroom.
Well, they're particularly vital in cases of child sex abuse or child murder because those are so highly charged. People cannot accept easily the idea that the random nature of things has taken my child. There's got to be someone who perpetrated it, some cause. And the experts provide a reason to support the testimony of the prosecutor's case. If there's somebody charged and their testimony, either, say, at a child who was supposedly abused or at a daycare center, the child will typically say one thing and then say another thing. But people are torn between a great sympathy for this child and unease about all the contradictions and the implausibilities. All of that is resolved if you have a doctor. A doctor who can stand up and reassure everyone by saying that there are distortions in the hymen that could only have been caused by sexual abuse, and that effectively resolves the case. it's of powerful evidence that trumps any and all other contradictions or implausibilities offered by the defendant.
So let's talk about how this same ruling affects child sexual abuse cases. But I think there is clearly a corrective operating in the field, certainly of people who evaluate child abuse cases, that for so long before the child abuse syndrome was identified, the injuries of children were just dismissed as random accidents. Well, kids fall, you know, stuff happens. And so this idea of just stuff just happens randomly has been used for a long time to explain away intentionally inflicted injuries. So is there also a kind of overcorrecting on the part of evaluators? Because I think there's the experts in the court, but then there's also the doctors and emergency workers, crisis workers who intervene on the scene and are very mindful of how these cases have been overlooked as accidents in the past.
Well, you're right about the dialectic. It's just how the world works. Something isn't noticed at all, and then when it's seen everywhere. Like if you want to buy a convertible, suddenly you'll see them all over the place. And people prosecute, and they noticed possible examples of a shaken baby syndrome. They created a syndrome, then to speak for it, to describe this wounds to infants in particular and toddlers. But on the ground, in the courtroom, when you've got somebody in the dock facing 2 decades in prison or freedom, you resolve disputes with experts. And there's a huge demand for experts. There's a demand that they supply a kind of resolution that's just unavailable otherwise. So prosecutors want them, defendants want them, and that demand has created a supply of absolutely what we call junk science. People rush to supply an objective explanation. And they will supply one, for example, talking about the way a normal hymen looks. A normal hymen was described in the 80s and 90s in dozens of cases as a perfect wedding ring-like circle. No one was ever curious enough to develop a normal range of the appearance of a hymen until there were so many people being tried and convicted and sent to prison on the basis of testimony about what a hymen looked like. And a vivid moment in my work with Debbie Nathan on a book in the early 80s was listening to a tape of the doctor who first developed a broad range of the appearance of a hymen joking to his colleagues by saying, well, we had to look at 206 children before we found a normal hymen. But there was no laughter in the room because the people listening to him had all testified against defendants with success and sent them away to prison.
Of course, that research would require vaginal exams on young girls, and so you might say that the areas that are hidden, that are kind of heavily symbolically and ideologically loaded, lend themselves to this kind of both ideas about female purity and other kind of ideological and morally driven fantasies the hymen is a good example of that, as a kind of somewhat mythical but highly symbolically charged part of a woman's body in patriarchal societies. I mean, it must have just been hard to do the research to clarify.
It was a very elegant project. It was done in Fresno, California. And the way they recruited the kids was first they offered free exams for summer camp, free total health exams. So they got hundreds of kids signing up. Then they said there will be indicated there will be examinations for sex abuse. So there were a lot of people who dropped out. There were a lot of parents who pulled their kids out. The ones that there were about 3 or 4 filter systems, and they came up with people who were basically not at all likely to have been abused. You can't, of course, say nobody was, but there were a lot of obvious ways to develop a pool. And then they proceeded to do very close colposcopic photographs and do like a 2 and 3 hour exam to get absolutely clear pictures.
I wonder what the girls were told about the exam, because it's uncommon for pre-puberty girls to have that kind of gynecological exam. But that's perhaps a story for another day about the challenges of science.
Yeah, Dr. John McCann is the man who published it, and he described in great detail exactly how he set the whole experiment
up. What he told the children.
And the lengths he went to in order to supply a wide-ranging, normal, and probably not abused population.
So getting back to this ruling, it's called Senate Bill 344, that allows cases to be appealed based on new scientific evidence that overrides earlier science. There, you're saying that this overextension or overreach of the authority of science is more apt to happen in very emotionally charged, kind of morally driven cases involving child abuse. Seems to be pretty vulnerable to this kind of thing. Are there other cases that were affected by this ruling?
Well, the statute was very elegant, very simple, and it's a state statute. So in theory, you could challenge bad science with a due process claim in federal court. But in practice, that's going to take years with unlikely results. And this statute is something that people follow. If your legislators, people you vote for, pass it, people will heed what it means. And it's a simple one. You just simply have to it tells you exactly in their post-conviction statute how to present it. And it's had a profound impact already. The San Antonio Four, they're called. There are four women in San Antonio known as lesbians in the mid-90s were convicted for of sexually abusing the two nieces of one of the four. And a critical part of the evidence was testimony about the lacerations, quote unquote, in the hymen of one of
the labia.
No, I think that's the Keller case. There were two cases in Texas. One of them, an old daycare case, Fran and Dan Keller, were convicted and sentenced in Austin, Texas, to many decades in prison for sexually abusing the people in their charge. Then there were the four women, who came to be known as the San Antonio Four. They developed a lot of support politically over the last 3 or 4 years. Were also convicted, and in both cases...
And they were convicted of raping...
Yes.
...two girls, right?
Yes. In both cases, the doctors themselves have recanted, because there have been normative studies developed about different parts of female anatomy that had not been available at that time. And they have both said that we were wrong. This was... could easily have been and part of a normal body that has not affected by any active or malevolent forces. It could have just been what it was. And
so has that unusual for a medical expert to recant or revise their view and acknowledge later they're wrong, or is it more often a court that trumps their earlier expertise?
It's extremely unusual. I mean, for one, you're opening yourself up to a possible civil liability lawsuit. I mean, it's a brave person who will say that they were wrong in any walk of life, and particularly in that one. It just doesn't happen much at all.
So that's quite a noble moment in a way in the history of experts who make a ton of money doing this kind of work.
They would have had a hard time defending their position. You know, they had a completely hopeless position to maintain. So I think they weighed and balanced and decided to come clean.
So before we close, let's just talk for a few minutes about the National Center for Reason and Justice. You're president of that center, and you're very involved in cases around child abuse and political education around them. Can you say a bit about the center and how people might become learn about or become involved in that work?
Well, it's called the NCRJ as a matter of practice, and ncrj.org is the website, and it was created to look carefully at and defend cases that nobody else will speak up for. Prosecutions of people for child sex abuse or child murder, the proliferation of syndromes that make it easier to target particular people and to obtain convictions. The fact that, like arson cases, for example, when are prosecuted as capital crimes, when children die, and even when the science supporting it, and that's usually the only evidence, are so-called experts talking about crazed glass and deliberate perpetration, but they happen with cases involving children. And whenever there's a dead child, the emotions could not be higher, and the likelihood of there being justice dwindles. And nobody on any political branch is eager to speak up or even willing to talk about the way that prosecutions for shaken baby syndrome or arson or child sex abuse can be supported by evidence that is weak or even fabricated or from as a result of junk science. The problems with these cases are so rife and so neglected, so overlooked, so avoided, that we decided to try to fill that gap.
It's important work. So there's a lot of unreason that prevails in and that overrides justice in these cases, even setting aside the normal injustices of our legal system, criminal justice system. Okay, thanks so much, Mike. This is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the recent recent case in Texas based on Senate Bill 344. Nice to have a positive shout out to Texas today around a progressive law. Thanks so much for being with us.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement has been our engineer. The music today has been by Santana from his classic blues album called Blues for Salvador. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As Moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. Just go to our webpage at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And this is KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Coming up this morning on KBOO, At 10, Air Cascadia is off today. We'll hear an excerpt from the series Between the Lines. At 10:15 on Locus Focused, host Barbara Bernstein speaks with Helen Yost, a spokesperson for Wild Idaho Rising Tide, about her organization's campaign against the megaloads rumbling through the Northwest. At 11 on Health Watch, host David Naiman interviews allergy specialist Dr. Suzanne Bennett about the 7-day allergy makeover. And at 11:30 on Health and Healthcare Forum, host Roberta Hall speaks with Oregon State Representative Mitch Greenlick and Jim Thompson about the Basic Health Program, which will provide affordable health insurance for some people currently not covered. Thank you.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. The time is 10 o'clock. Air Cascadia is off today. Instead, we are going to hear an excerpt from the series Between the Lines.
Alice Rothschild is an obstetrician from the Boston area who was raised in a Jewish household. Growing up, she was a Zionist who supported the State of Israel. When she traveled to Israel with her family, she remembers never having seen the Palestinians who lived there. In 1997, Rothschild began trying to understand the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and has since organized many delegations to the West Bank, Gaza, and Israel with a strong contingent of medical professionals. In 2007, she published a book titled Broken Promises, Broken Dreams, which examines the roots of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In her 2013 documentary film called Voices Across the Divide, she features interviews with Palestinians about the conflict, some of whom recount their personal memories of the turbulent time in history when, during the birth of Israel in 1948, more than 700,000 Palestinians were driven from their land and homes. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Rothschild after a screening of her film at the Yale University Law School in late February.
Just explain the divide as you understand it.
Well, I don't think there's only one divide. And the more I look at this conflict, the more divides I see. So the name Voices Across the Divide was referring to me as a Jewish woman going across whatever divides there are that separate me from my Palestinian cousins and trying to figure out what their lives are about.
We're in a situation now where the relatively new Secretary of State has really made achieving peace in the Middle East, I guess, priority number one. The idea of a two-state solution, do you think that that is still even possible?
Well, I think the idea of a two-state solution, which came out of the Oslo Accords, may possibly have been possible at that point, although there's a lot of question about what kind of states they would be. When I'm in the region now and I look at the massive settlement growth, the bypass roads that only people with Israeli license plates can go on, the fact that the Jordan Valley is now a military zone and Palestinians are not allowed to live there except around Jericho. When I look at what some people call the Bantustanization or the Cantonization of the West Bank, I don't see a viable state. And then if you look at the separation wall, 85% of it is within the West Bank. It's very hard for me to imagine what kind of state they're thinking about. So, you know, I'm sure that there are many people that are for the two-state solution, but they don't ask what kind of state. And if Palestinians don't have a state that is contiguous with itself, that doesn't have borders with other countries, if they don't have some control over their water and their air and all the things that a state has to have, it's not going to be viable. At this point in history, I think that the behavior of the Israeli government has removed the chance of a two-state solution. And in fact, if you look at Netanyahu's cohorts and his party, they're not in favor of a two-state solution. And there are plenty of people in his camp that believe in a greater Israel, and I think that's what they've created. So for me, as a Jewish activist, I see the struggles ahead as more one a struggle against apartheid rather than a struggle for a two-state solution. And I see that struggle has to do with human rights for all in the region and not the privileging of Jewish rights over Palestinian rights.
Another thing that I think is one of the hot issues in the region is the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which is a Palestinian civil society movement that started in 2005 and is really, as you said in your talk tonight, picking up steam. Talk about your view of the BDS campaign and especially the academic and cultural boycott, because I think there's really a lot of misunderstanding of what it is.
So, first of all, I see Palestinian civil society engaged in a liberation struggle. And I feel that this is a nonviolent struggle and that we as fellow activists who are interested in human rights need to respect the call. It is clear to me that the cultural and academic boycotts are the most complicated. They involve issues of freedom of speech and, you know, hearing the other and all those kind of things. And it is very clear to me also that there will be problems with people having their voices heard if there is a real cultural and academic boycott. On the other hand, it's not that you can't invite an Israeli professor to your university in the United States. That's completely allowed. What's not allowed is to set up, for instance, like the joint program between Cornell and the Technion, where the institutions on an institutional level are having a joint program. And the reason for that is to call attention to the fact that so many Israeli universities either have huge military contracts, are involved in developing security apparatus, have campuses on the West Bank, have campuses on destroyed Palestinian villages. I mean, it's calling attention to the complicity of universities in the occupation. The other thing that the academic boycott is calling attention to is the fact that Palestinian universities are under occupation, that professors can't get permits, that American professors can't get permits to go work in a Palestinian university. I mean, there's a huge amount of repression and lack of being heard going on in Palestinian academic settings that we're completely oblivious to. I think it's really something we need to take seriously.
That was Alice Rothschild discussing her documentary film about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict titled Voices Across the Divide. For more information about the film and related issues, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In an investigative piece titled The Wolf of Sesame Street, Revealing the Secret Corruption Inside PBS's News Division, published on the news website Pando Daily, journalist David Sirota wrote about a public broadcasting service news series titled The Pension Peril, which advocated cuts to public employee pension benefits. The Pension Peril series, scheduled to be broadcast by PBS stations across the country over the course of 2 years, Sirota reveals, was secretly funded by former Enron company trader and billionaire John Arnold. Arnold, who had donated $3.5 million to PBS for the production of the Pension Peril series, is a passionate and longtime critic of public employee pensions. As Sirota reports, through his foundation, Arnold has made large contributions to politicians, political action committees, and think tanks to advance his campaign to slash public employee retirement benefits. Disturbingly, the PBS series presented views critical of pension funds very similar to that of its funder, without revealing to the audience